Anyway, song of songs. So we left off. Now, we always have to keep in mind that this is about a groom who, the writer of the book is Solomon, who actually was Solomon. The bride, who is actually a Shulamite woman that he did in fact marry along with 300 other women. So it's based on that. And then there's all these other characters like the women and the brothers and the, you know, and this is a metaphor for the church. The bride is the church, of course. And in Ephesians 5, it says we're going to be presented as a pure and spotless bride, which not one single person is pure and spotless. The church is definitely not pure and spotless in her humanity. And in our humanity, we're certainly not pure and spotless, but, you know, Jesus is the groom. And so this whole book is the relationship between the groom and the bride and all the bumps that the bride has, and the groom sometimes is wooing her, sometimes is being with her, sometimes pulls away for a while, then comes back. And that when we left off at the end of chapter one, she meets the groom and she's excited. And, you know, we can't go through it all again because we did two sessions on chapter one. But, you know, at the end, they're in a beautiful house that's made out of cypress and fir and greens and cedar. And cedar is, of course, you know, the cedars of Lebanon are the most famous cedars. That's what we use to build the temple. Cedar is very strong, it smells really good, and it doesn't rot. So when you build the relationship with the groom, when you build your relationship with Christ, it's a solid building that doesn't rot. Your relationship doesn't rot. It's not a temporary thing. And like Jesus himself said, you know, it's, you build on the rock, your house doesn't fall down. You build on the sand, your house falls down every time there's a bad storm. So the whole foundation is this strong wood that doesn't rot, and it smells really good. And it's green. And, you know, it talks about, you can look through it or listen to the other thing. You know, the couch is green, the rafters are pine. All these things are beautiful, and they smell really good. So now she's come to know the groom, and she has a house. In other words, she's come to the Messiah. She understands who he is, and she's happy and comfortable and living in a nice place. And this is where, you know, a lot of people are in their relationship because they think, well, they live in a nice place now that they know the Messiah, so everything should be fine. But now comes the time of testing starts. The time of, you're not going to just sit here in this beautiful house made out of cedar and watch TV and sleep. You got to come out and do something with me. You got to come out and, we got work to do. And nobody really wants to hear that. Because, you know, she's worried about her cholesterol and her blood pressure pills, and she's worried about her knee hurting and all this other nonsense, that she doesn't want to do what the groom wants her to do. And so now the story is going to start to take on some intensity. Because now it's kind of like she wants to just be in the honeymoon. You know, it's like the me and Jesus people. I got me and Jesus. Well, that's nice, but it's a little more difficult than that. You know, Jesus said, if you don't hate your father and mother, you can't be my disciple. Son of man has no place to lay his head. You know, it's not always going to be nice. Sometimes it's going to be nice, but sometimes it's not going to be nice. And we're not here for our own existence. We're not here just for our existence. It's not about us. We're here as part of his plan. So when he wants to work his plan through the bride sometimes says, well, wait a minute. This is not what I bargained for. I thought we were just going to stay in this cool house and sit here and watch TV and eat and relax. So this is where chapter two starts. Now remember, some translations have who's talking. Now chapter two, somebody read, verse one and two.
Sharon, the lily of the valley, as the lily among thorns, so is my beloved upon me. As an apple tree among the trees of the woods, so is my lover among men.
Okay, it's done. Okay, so, first of all, we should say that Sharon is an area in the northern part of Israel. It's right on the Mediterranean. It's right below Mount Carmel. It's known for beautiful flowers. It's very rich soil. They have crops. They have beautiful flowers. They have animals. It's beautiful scenery. It's a rich, rich area. So, Rose of Sharon, is one of the messianic titles for Jesus. Because the rose is the most beautiful flower. And in the place where it has the best flowers, the best soil, the best plants, he's the most beautiful of all of them. So in other words, you go someplace where everything is really nice and everything is really beautiful, but compared to him, not as nearly as beautiful. Nothing compares to that. So he's the Rose of Sharon. This is the only place in the scripture that that's used as one of his titles. Just like in one place in Genesis, he's called Shiloh, meaning the Messiah. Nobody really knows why. It's the only place it's used. The ark stays at Shiloh for a couple of hundred years. So there's some identification between Shiloh and the holy things. But Rose of Sharon is one of the best young titles. It's the only place it's used. And then you hear about it kind of in popular stuff too. And all the best roses grew there. All the best flowers. And you see it says, lily of the valleys. And we always hear that term, lily of the valleys. The lily's preferred over everything. You know, lily's another beautiful flower. You know, Jesus talked about it in Luke 12:27, where he said, you know, Solomon was clothed in all kinds of splendor, but compared to a lily, he was a goofy looking dude. I mean, Solomon in all his glory is not arrayed like one of these. Like, no matter how good we make ourselves look, we can't look like a rose or a lily. It's a superb creation. And now, you know, he's trying to tell the bride, you know, I'm the most awesome being that there is. Nothing else compares to me. And this isn't about sitting in a house. I don't just stay in my garden. I don't just stay in my house. I'm everywhere. He's present everywhere. He's in the valley are the low places. A lily's white and pure. So he's a lily, he's white and he's pure. And generally at this time, like humble people lived in valleys and did the farms and stuff. You know, the rich people all lived in Jerusalem, which was up on, the mountains. But humble people see the glory more than high class people do. Like Jesus said, it's easier for a camel to go through a needle's eye than a rich man to go to heaven. Because they're distracted by seeing too many things. But a poor, humble person sees the beauty of salvation and says, wow, that's what I want. And this is the same with a lily. It's redemption. And then he identifies her as a lily. See, as a lily among brambles, so is my love among maidens. So the bride is like a lily. It's a beautiful white creation. And in the first part, he's talking about he's a lily. Now the bride's also a lily. So we have the same purity that he has based on that. Remember when we studied Romans, as you know, in chapter 8 it says, we become adopted sons and daughters. We become co-heirs with Christ. You know, he's the true son, we're the adopted children. But as adopted children, we're co-heirs. So that means we inherit the same thing he inherits. What does he inherit? Everything. So do we. You know, in heaven we're going to be judging angels. says, we'll judge the 12 tribes of Israel. We'll judge angels. The angels are going to be scared of us. Because you're going to point to some big, powerful angel and say, you, go get me some more coffee, just a little bit of cream, and hurry up. Step on it. Because it says we're going to be judging angels. And so the lily, he compares the bride to himself. Because the believers are as beautiful as he is. Now remember, he's seeing us in our completed condition. He's not looking at like our baldness and our fatness and our, you know, weakness and our, he's looking at the finished person that we're going to be. We're going to be just as beautiful as he is in, you know, in a lot of respects. Because he makes us like him. Remember, we're transformed a little at a time to be like Christ. That's the whole point of the gospel, is that you're transformed a little at a time to be like him. You know, Paul, remember Paul said, the good things I don't want to do, the good things I want to do, I don't do. The bad things I don't want to do, that's what I keep on doing. Because that's, you know, that's what we struggle with all the time. But eventually we're going to be lilies just like he is. And then it says, see, the bride is a lily among the thorns. And that's us. We're believers in the world. You know, the world's a bunch of, you know, the Bible calls them tares and weeds and thorns. So we're like lilies growing up here and there. There's not many of us. And remember, just because somebody's sitting next to you in the pew doesn't mean they're on board. There's not that many lilies left. But we're growing in this field among the sin and the sinners in the world. But we're lilies. And we have to live with them. We have to live with the tribulation that goes on. Everything's made up of saints and sinners. I mean, we're sinners too, but different than the unrepentant sinners. Like Luther said, we're at the same time sinners and saints. Because we still sin, but we're following. You're still going to fall down, and then you're going to get back up and go. It's a difference between the sinner who does that and the sinner who just says, oh, I don't care, I'm going to do whatever I want. And doesn't have repentance or remorse or contrition or, you all probably know plenty of people like that. At least when we do something bad, we know that we've done something bad. So we're saints among sinners, plus we're his inheritance. You know, in Psalm 2:8 and Ephesians 1:18, it says, you know, we're going to be his inheritance. If somebody wants to find those, you can read it well. We're talking, but, you know, the Father promises the Son, if you do these things, if you follow the plan, and of course the Son's going to follow the plan, but those prophecies are there for our purposes, not his purposes. Like the Father didn't have to worry, was Jesus going to go through with this or not? Boy, I hope he's going to go through with this. If this was planned long before anything was created. But for our purposes, the Father says, you know, if he follows, if he does, then he's gonna see his descendants in a long line. He's gonna inherit everything. And you see that, we're gonna see too in the next couple of verses, outside of the Trinity, you know, the Trinity we're not even gonna talk about. There's relationships within the Godhead that nobody can understand. Right? If somebody tells you they understand the Trinity, you know right away that they don't. if somebody says, oh, I got that Father, Son, Spirit thing down, I'll tell you how it works. No. Like I heard a guy yesterday say, well, you know, you can look at a hard-boiled egg and, you know, the shell is the egg and the white is the egg and the yolk is the egg, so there's three in one. I said, no. That doesn't cover it because they're different compositions. They're the same egg. The Father, Son, and Spirit are the same essence. They're the same substance. You know, the consubstantial is the new Crete says, which I like much better. I forget what the Greek word is, homogiosis or something. It's the same substance, the same essence, but three individual identities. The Father's not the Son, the Son's not the Spirit's not the Father. So when somebody tells you they understand that, you know right away that they don't. But outside of the Trinity, the bride is the only thing that God really wants. Imagine that. The only thing he desires is the bride. Remember, he didn't do this for the angels. If all the angels would have been lost, he still would have died for man. There's no plan of salvation for angels. That's why when we studied Hebrews, we saw the angels marvel at our redemption. His only desire, and not only does he love us, he wants a relationship like a marital relationship. He wants us to be co-heirs with him. It's not just, I really like the humans. I think the humans are nice. They're entertaining. They're kind of fun to watch. Yeah. It isn't that. Because, you know, as we go through this ridiculous Christmas season we just went through, what people should be thinking about is those prophecies from Isaiah and what the incarnation is. Not all this nonsense that we hear and see, including in the church we see nonsense. Nobody even talks about those prophecies and what they really mean. Because if you talked about those readings in Isaiah, you would be blown away that God is with us. But the idea of the incarnation is the ultimate proof of this. That his desire for us is more than anything else other than the within the Godhead. And we know that because in John, Jesus also says, as the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. You know, we read that, you know, you hear that verse 100 times during your life, and you say, yeah, that's nice, he loves everybody. He loves everyone. But he loves us as the Father loves him. What does that mean? How do you get that? How do you understand that? How do you deal with that? We have no concept what that means. So outside of the Trinity, the bride is the main thing that he desires. And she's clean and beautiful and innocent and pure. And remember, she said, I'm dark, like the tents of Kedar. But I'm also like the curtains of Solomon. Because we have both things. We're dark, but he makes us clean. You know, if we had to go to heaven by being clean, there'd be nobody there. If we had to earn our way in, there'd be nobody there. So all you'd have to do is fall once, and that'd be the end. So he looks at the bride as pure. Before that, she said, oh, no, I'm really dark. But see, we have to understand as believers, as people that are following, what this means. This is life-changing. This isn't the Jesus loves everyone. He loves me. I love him. He loves Joe. He loves Nancy. He loves Mary. He loves Steve. Yeah, of course. But it isn't just that kind of a trite thing. It's overwhelming. We can't understand it. Because if you could go to heaven by being good, or if you could go to heaven by being nice, or if you could go to heaven by doing 58 other things, then Jesus was mentally ill. Because he wouldn't have had to die. Certainly not like that. Everybody saw the Passion of the Christ. What does that teach you? The only way that sin can be dealt with. So, when we understand that, we realize, wow, if he loves me that much and he's willing to do that for me and he wants me to be in the bride that's going to be his body, going to be at the marriage supper of the Lamb, that's pretty exciting. What do I care what my cholesterol is or what time I get out of work or whether it's this or that or whether it's raining or snowing? Who cares compared to that? So she's a lily among the thorns. Then he went into verse 3. As an apple tree among the trees of the wood. Read that again. Read 3. Yeah, read 3 again.
As an apple tree among the trees of the woods, so was my lover among men. I delight to rest in the shadow, and his fruit is sweet to my mouth.
So an apple tree. What's an apple tree do? It gives you sweet fruit. Everybody likes apples. It's rare to meet somebody who doesn't like apples. So it gives you a sweet fruit. It's refreshing. When you eat an apple, it's refreshing. Cleans out your mouth, cleans out your throat. You know, other trees, you know, are useful. Other trees have fruits. A lot of trees, you have to cut them down before you can use them, before they're useful to you. But he's preeminent over all the trees. He's preeminent over everything. It's an apple tree. It's preeminent over everything. And you see, she sits in the shade. You know, we sit in the shade of the apple tree. Because of what he did, we're refreshed. You know, we sit in the shade of the tree, the cross, and we can just sit there. Because the cross is what's important. You know, the cross is what draws people. You know, Jesus said, when I'm lifted up from the earth, going back to this bronze serpent, I draw men to myself. You know, the cross is a tree. It's commonly called the tree. So if we sit in the shade of the cross, that's where we're safe. That's where we're refreshed. Now, she hasn't even done anything yet. Jesus is telling all this stuff about her, about how beautiful she is and all this stuff and a nice house and you're a lily. She hasn't done anything yet. All she's been doing is kind of hanging out. So he loves her before she even does anything. In other words, just not earning his love. He already loves her. And she's sitting in his presence, and God likes when we just sit in his presence. You can just sit there and be with them. You don't have to be doing something. You don't necessarily have to be, you know, preaching the gospel in Singapore. You can just be sitting there with him. And that's good for him, too. I don't want to say good for him, but you know what I mean. He loves that. But it's really good for us. You know, the part of the how the bride is going to mature as the book goes on is she's going to understand that just like sitting with him is important. Just like being with him. Like when we're in heaven, we're just going to be with him. And that's what's going to be happiness. We're not going to be doing anything like tasks. We're just going to be there. And so being in the shade of the apple tree is what she's doing right now. She's just being with him. And he loves it. And fruit, you know, the apple's also fruit. You know, we're supposed to bear fruit when we're believers. You know, how many gospels are there that said, you know, if a tree doesn't bear fruit, you cut it down and throw it in the fire. And you don't want it just using up the nutrients in the soil. Okay. So we're fed by the fruit. You know, it's like sitting at the Lord's table with him when you're sitting under the tree. You know, we're fed by that. And in that way, you know, the redemption that comes to us through him from the cross, it's a sweet thing, like fruit. There isn't anything sweeter in the world to think that you're saved because you know what you really are. You know, somebody else may not know what you're really like, but you know what you're really like. And to think that you can be saved, that's pretty good. I mean, that's pretty exciting. And it's a sweet thing to know the redemption, just like eating the sweet fruit. And people that are judgmental or people that are all involved in these are the rules try to, you know, can take that happiness away from you. Because you can say, well, I didn't follow that rule very well. And then you start thinking about the rule rather than, wow, I've been sitting here with him. It's not about the rules. So it's a sweet thing. Now, she hasn't done anything yet. She hasn't, like, fed a hungry guy. She hasn't collected money. She hasn't run the pancake breakfast. She hasn't done bingo yet. She hasn't done anything. Okay, now, how about four?
He brings me into the banquet hall. and his emblem over me is love.
Woo.
You hear that quoted all the time, his banner over me is love. His banner over us is love. One of the great readings from Isaiah was it referred to Messiah is going to come and he's going to stand as a banner for his people. He's going to stand as a banner for his people, Israel, and the nations are going to come, us. Nations always refers to Gentiles. Remember in the camp how each tribe had its banner? So like if you walked into the camp and, you know, you were in the tribe of Dan, but you got separated because you had to go to the bathroom and you missed where they went, you'd look around and say, oh, there's Dan over there, because you'd see the banner. So you'd go to where the banner was. And each tribe had a banner. Remember, one of God's names is Yahweh Nisi, Jehovah Nisi, Adonai Nisi, the Lord of the Banners. Because the camp was so beautiful with all the banners flying. Remember when Balaam was going to curse him and he saw that beautiful camp and he said, wow, how beautiful this is. So just like the people knew where their tribe was by looking at the banner, Isaiah says he's going to be a banner for his people and the nations are going to come to him. The banner is Jesus on the cross. We're the nations. We go to him. We're not even the covenant people. But we go to him. He's the banner. He's the ensign. And a lot of translations say he's an ensign for the people. So in other words, you see, that's where I got to go. Because there's the banner. It's the cross. We don't have tribes. You know, we're unclean Gentiles. We're not covenant people. But now we've been to the banner. So we are clean and we are covenant people. Right? Had we been in Jerusalem in Jesus' time, we wouldn't have been allowed in the temple. But now we get to run everything. Because he stands as a banner. That's one of Isaiah's great messianic prophecies. It says the nations will go to him. Which is what happened. You believe it? All these Gentiles who didn't have a clue who Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were, didn't know one law from another, didn't have a clue what was going on in the temple, yet they became believers in the Jewish Messiah. So see, she was sitting under the apple tree, but now they go to a special place. He takes her to a special place now. A banqueting house. The Hebrew there actually means it's a wine house. It's a place that's fun. It's a place where there's all kinds of stuff to eat and to drink. It's a celebration place. It's, you know, we look at it as, it's the communion with him. You know, the marriage supper of the Lamb is going to be a feast. Look how many times in the scripture heaven's called the marriage supper of the Lamb. How many times Jesus gives parables about, oh, a king wanted to give a wedding feast for his son. And he's talking about him. He's talking about himself. So, you know, it's a marriage supper. It's a communion table. He brings her there to the table. It's the marriage supper. The father's there. You know, he's the father of the groom, so to speak. So he brings her into the presence of the father in this celebration, which is a marriage supper. So she's not sitting under the tree anymore. She's like, wow, she's in this place where there's all kind of celebration going on. I didn't know that until I was 44 years old that there was such a thing. I thought religion was supposed to be, blah, 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 blah. You were supposed to be miserable. You know, so you'd see a whole bunch of miserable people that would say, don't you want to be in our church? And I'd say, no. I want to be with happy people. But, you know, it's like a shepherd carrying the sheep. You know, you see all these analogies of Jesus with the sheep, either in his arms or over his neck. You know, he carries her to this place. Just doesn't say, oh, let me go see what's going on over there with that celebration. He takes her there. He takes us there. We can't go there on our own. We can't say, hey, Lord, how about if I show up at the marriage supper? How's that? Well, Jesus tells you how's that. He's going to say, hey, how come you're here? You're not supposed to be here. Get out of here and you're going to wail and gnash your teeth. So he carries her there like you carry a sheep. And the banner over the whole thing is love. Because all of this is done in love. Doesn't have to be done. The human race could have been vaporized. Adam and Eve could have been vaporized. God could have said, well, let's forget this now. It didn't work out so well. Let's start over again. Didn't have to do it. Didn't have to give a plan of salvation. Doesn't have to save us. Don't deserve salvation. But the banner over it is love. Love always reigns over everything. And it's not a banner. You know, the banner isn't laws and rules and judgments and fear and uncertainty. The banner's love. You know, it's not a banner of, here's all the rules. You ain't meet on Friday, you're in big trouble, bub. You wore brown shoes instead of black shoes. Oh. You stood in the wrong place to say the prayer. The banner's love. And you know, as it says in Hebrew, he's the author and the captain of our salvation, is the author of our salvation, because he brings us there. And the banner over all of that is love. And again, here's another thing that was so important during Advent. You have the reading that the virgin will conceive and bear a son, and he's going to be named Emmanuel. But his name wasn't Emmanuel. Then later, the angel's going to say to Mary, you're going to conceive and bear a son, you're going to name him Jesus. Joseph has a dream. The angel says, you're going to have a son, you're going to name him Jesus. Don't worry about this baby. She hasn't been with anybody else. She hasn't been running around. Joseph knew this wasn't his baby. Got to be somebody's baby. Wasn't his. I mean, imagine the anguish he went through. See, we never think about that, because we think St. Joseph was just... You know, a betrothal didn't mean they were just kind of dating. It was a marriage, except they weren't living together. Then she comes and says she's pregnant. I mean, how would any man react to that? You'd say, what? I can't believe this. So the angel says to him, don't worry about this baby, but you're going to name him Jesus. And what's it say after that? Because he's going to save his people from his sins. Right? So why'd they pick the name Jesus? Why didn't they name him Levi or Moses or Judah or Eleazar? Why'd they name him Jesus? Because his name means salvation. Mary and Joseph would have immediately understood that. You're going to name this baby Salvation. Because he's going to save the people from their sins. Yes, and there were many people named Yeshua. He wasn't the only one. But his name meant salvation. So his name is his job description. Yeah. With us. Emmanuel, God with us. And then later, John, in John's Gospel, chapter 1, he expands on that. It says, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The Greek there means pitches his tent with us. So God pitches his tent next to us. So in terms of 2014, it means he moves into the neighborhood. You say, well, God lives in the third house from the corner over there. That's why Isaiah's so awesome. I know we'd rather learn about Padre Pio, but Isaiah's so awesome. He says, the God-man, the Messiah is going to live with us. He's going to be us. He's going to have our nature. And so the banner's love. And, you know, I don't even know how to describe it. It's a showing about that banner, because the love is so intense that in order to save us, he had to have both natures. He had to be God, had to be man. Couldn't be one or the other. A man can't save you, and God can't die. So he has to have both natures. So that the cup of wrath is poured on him and not on you. So all the stuff about cups in Gethsemane, you know, it's a horrible thing. Horrible thing. And the readers, they just gloss over it, but the cup means it's the ugly, sickening wrath of every horrible thing is in that cup. Olives. So this is overwhelming, because now she's come to him, they have a relationship, she had this beautiful house, and now she's in this place of celebration. So now, in chapter 5, go ahead, somebody read, let's read 5, 6, and 7. No, verse 5. 5, 6, and 7.
Restore my strength with raisins and refresh me with apples. I am weak from fashion. His left hand is under my head and his right hand caresses me. Promise me, women of Jerusalem, swear by the swift deer and the gazelles that you will not interrupt our love.
So now the bride's talking. And she's talking to the daughters of Jerusalem. Now the daughters we would look at as people in the church who don't get what you have. The people that are aggravated by the fact that you're zealous and excited. Why can't you just go to 10:30 mass like everybody else and why don't you just walk in and walk out like everybody else does? Why are you going on and on about how awesome this is and how awesome that is and why are you talking about Jesus all the time? So, you know, people who are zealous about Jesus, other people don't like it. But anyway, so now she's talking to the people in the pew. But anyway, so now the bride's lovesick. See what she's saying in there? She's overcome. He has to sustain her. I'm sick with love. She's overwhelmed. She's lovesick. All the stuff that's happened so far. She hasn't done anything yet. But, you know, she has to be refreshed now because she's overcome by all this. So raisins and apples, you know, they're fruits, sweet fruits. The fruit of redemption. You know, we're not fed with harshness and bitterness and here's more rules for you to do. We're fed with sweetness. You know, this is Holy Spirit ministry where you understand what's happened and the Spirit opens your mind and your eyes to what's gone on and you say, wow, I didn't know this before. This is where she is now. The daughters of Jerusalem are still saying, why don't you just go to 10:30 mass like a normal person? I can't tell you in a course of a week how many people say that to me. Why can't you just go to church on Sunday like a normal person? I say, because I don't want to be normal. Why would I want to be normal? So he awakens this hunger in us that we want to do more things. We want to know more things. And he's the only one that can satisfy us. And, you know, it says also in John's Gospel, I don't have the exact reference, but, you know, we love him because he loved us first. We don't go out looking for Jesus every day to love him. Just because he loved us first, that's why we go after him. There's no way we can sit at home and figure out that Jesus loves us and so here's what we're going to do. He loved us first, so that's why we love him. So she's overwhelmed by this now. And, you know, his left hand, now when you're cradling somebody in your arms, you can't see their left hand. He's got it under her head. See what it says there? His left hand's under my head and his right hand embraces me. So in other words, he's holding her in his lap with her head in his left arm, his right arm's over here. She can't see the left hand, but there's still activity going on. You know, God's holding her up, the groom's holding her up, but she can't see the arm. You know, the Lord's always doing things in your life that you can't always see. It's like might be right behind your head. You can't see it, but he's holding you up. He's interacting in your life and you don't even see it sometimes until all of a sudden you realize it. All of a sudden you realize it. So a lot of things go on, you know, he supports you like a pillow, you know, his left hand's like a pillow, it's holding up her head. The right hand we can see, you know, he's caressing her or holding something or doing, what he's doing with his right hand, she can see, but she can't see his left hand, except she knows he's holding him up. He's holding her up. Then in verse 7, it's like she asks these people, don't bother me now. I don't want to hear about all your whininess. I don't want to hear your complaining. I don't want to hear your criticisms of me. I know I'm weird. You know, people that are zealous and on fire make boring people nervous. They don't like it. You know, she says to them, I'm in his presence now, and I've had this experience, and I just want to enjoy it, so don't bother me. I don't want to hear all your complaints. And she talks about gazelles and does and stuff. Those are animals, as you know, that are easily disturbed. And when they're disturbed, they run off. So any little thing can make them run. And she knows that she can still be distracted. But she doesn't want to be distracted. She doesn't want this experience to end now. Now remember, she hasn't done anything yet. She hasn't even gone to church yet. Now comes the first test. Now we're going to see, this is going to be a new season. And then we're going to hear a song when we're done. We're going to have like an audio in a minute. Somebody start reading at 8 and read through the end. And if you get tired, somebody else can kick in. Because this all goes together.
This is the woman. I hear my lover's voice. He comes running over the mountains, racing across the hills to me. My lover is like a gazelle, like a young stag. There he stands beside the wall. He looks in through the window and glances through the lattice. My lover speaks to me. The man, come then, my love, my darling, come with me. The winter is over, the rains have stopped in the countryside, the flowers are in bloom. This is the time for singing. The song of doves is heard in the fields. Figs are beginning to ripen. The air is fragrant with blossoming vines. Come then, my love. My darling, come with me. You are like a dove at height in the crevice of the rock. Let me see your lovely face and hear your enchanting voice. Catch the foxes, the little foxes, before they ruin our vineyard in bloom.
I read the rest.
My lover belongs to me, then I to him. He browses among the lilies until the day breathes cool and the shadows lengthen. Roam, my lover, like a gazelle or a young stag upon the mountains of heaven.
Now, I don't like your translation, but that's okay. It says, you know, the beloved, she sees him coming, leaping over the mountain. Now, she's in the house. She sees him leaping over the mountains, comes right into the window. He's looking into the window. And he says, arise, my love, my dove, my fair one, and come with me. In other words, he says, come on, come with me now. You can't just sit in the house all the time. You got to come with me. So you notice he calls her, my love, my dove, my fair one. Remember, she's dark like the tents of Kedar. Remember we said doves don't have peripheral vision. They can only see straight. Remember at the end of chapter 1, he said you have dove's eyes. A dove can only see forward. So, you know, she's supposed to keep her eyes fixed on him. She can't look over here. She has to go this way. There's no peripheral vision. Straight ahead. So he's calling her out, and this is a new season now. She's been lovesick, but now it's time to do some work. It's time to do what he wants her to do. We're not going to have just the honeymoon anymore. It's a new revelation now. He's the sovereign king and he's the groom, but now she sees him in a different way. Because instead of him carrying her, caressing her, holding her, saying, wow, you're like a lily, you're like me, there's apples, there's raisins, now it's like, come on, let's go. Let's go out and start doing the stuff. And see, at first she rejoices. Look, the voice of my beloved, exclamation point. Did your thing say that? Did your translation have that? Verse 8, the voice of my beloved, exclamation point. Behold, he comes. You know, she's excited that he's coming toward her again. And she recognizes his voice. It's the voice of my beloved. Remember Jesus said, my sheep hear my voice. They don't go with a stranger. You know, when Jesus talks, the sheep hear him. When a stranger talks, they don't hear him. Sheep don't follow a stranger. We do the thing about the sheep gate sometime. It's a nice story. Because the person who the sheep know goes in the sheep gate and says, come on, sheep, let's go, and leads them out because they know his voice. We know his voice. So when we hear him telling us something, we know it's him, and so we go. If we hear another voice, we say, oh, I'm not going over there. That doesn't sound right. I don't think that guy over there's got raisin cakes and apples. I think he's just got bad stuff. So, you know, she recognizes his voice. Jesus said, we're not going to go after a stranger. So he comes leaping over the mountains, over every obstacle that's in the way. He comes toward her. There's no obstacles in the way. The law was an obstacle. The curse of the law, like we studied about in Romans, was an obstacle. You know, the law keeps people from knowing Jesus personally. Because everybody thinks it's all about rules. This is not a relationship about rules. He's coming over all that. He's leaping over all that. And he comes right at the right time. So he says, oh, here he comes. He's always going to come at the right time. It's always an appointed time. You know, Jesus wasn't born at that particular time just because it seemed like a nice time to do it. There was a reason. When the fullness of time had come. He wasn't born now. He wasn't born 100 years before or 200 years later. Then, because that's when it was supposed to be, for, you know, various reasons. The world was at peace, the Romans had roads, there were no conflicts going on, Paul and Peter and all those guys could travel on the Roman roads, there were ships going all over the place, everything was organized. And, you know, he comes fast, you know, he's jumping over these obstacles. He's a gazelle, he's a stag. And, you know, Jesus normally sits at the right hand of the Father until something's going on, then he stands up. Like when Stephen was being martyred, Stephen saw the vision of Jesus, got up and stood there and received his spirit. So he gets up when there's something's going to happen. Most of the time he's sitting. I mean, he doesn't literally sitting, but, you know, metaphorically sitting. So she's in the house that he built for her. And he's looking in through the window. And he tries to woo her out. You know, the church can also be in the house. Because we like to be in the church. We like to be in the building. It's nice and peaceful. It's nice and quiet. If there's something bad going on over there, we don't really want to go over there. We want to stay in the nice building. He wants to come in and get us to go out. Because it's not about us just enjoying it all the time. It's good to sit in his presence, but you also have to go out and do the stuff. And he gazes in and he speaks to her with love. You know, she's so dear to him that he wants her to come. He doesn't want to go by himself. He wants her to come. Now he's the one who sounds lovesick. See there? Arise, my love, my dove, my fair one. I mean, it's like a Shakespeare play. It's like, here's this, you know, I want this beautiful woman to come with me. I don't want to just go by myself. So, he's the one now that sounds lovesick. He calls her his love, his fair one. So in other words, come out of your quiet, secure, comfortable place and come with me. Because there's stuff going on out here. There's stuff going on out here. Come out. She's not mature yet. She doesn't want to go out. Later on, she's going to say to him, hey, come on, let's go up there where those grapes are grown and see what's going on. But she's not ready for that yet. She just wants to sit and, you know, there was the fruit and there was the nice stuff and there was the table and big screen TV and comfortable couch. So, you know, she wants to be sheltered. So now there's action going on the earth. We're going to get to. Jesus wants her to be a partner with him. Remember, everything's done through human beings. I mean, you can start... Where do you want to start? Adam and Eve, you know, Noah, Abraham, you know, all the patriarchs, Moses, all the prophets, Peter, Paul, all the evangelists of the first century. You know, everything for the kingdom was done through those people. You know, he uses us to do the work. Just like in Romans 10 when we learned that, you know, salvation comes from, faith comes from hearing. Hearing comes from preaching. Preaching comes from the Word of God. So we gotta go out, you know, how can they hear if someone doesn't tell them? How can somebody tell them if they're not sent? You know, somebody has to be sent. And so here, he's gonna use her as a partner to do the work. And if you look through there, there's seven verbs that are there. He's coming, leaping, skipping, standing, looking, gazing, speaking. He's doing all the activity, and she's just sitting. He's doing all the action. See that? And he's sitting. She's sitting while he's doing all the verbs. So now in 11, here's the key to this. The winter's over. Now remember, we're not talking about Ohio here. We're talking about the land. Growing season is a little different. Our harvest is like in October. You know, here the harvest, there's two or more harvests every year. Because as soon as the winter's over, boy, stuff's already growing. It's not like stuff doesn't start growing in May or June. In fact, pretty soon it's going to start growing. Another month or so, it's going to be spring there because the seasons change really fast. And so he's telling her, the winter's passed. You know, during the winter's the only time it rains. It never rains there in the summer. So the winter is passed. The rain's gone. So now it's time to do the work. Now it's time that things are going to grow. The winter's fruitless and dark, but now comes the springtime. Now is going to be the fruitful time. And she's got to come along with this. And what you have to understand here is that when he calls you to do something and says, come with me, you're so beautiful and you're my fair one and come on, he's going to make things happen. You don't have to worry. All you have to do is be willing to go. You don't have to say, well, but Lord, I have to go study at the, you know, seminary for 12 years. I can't do anything. I don't know anything. Whatever he wants you to do, he's going to equip you to do it. And what you have to do may be something a lot less complicated than go to the seminary for 12 years. You may just have to go reach two people. You may just have to go to one place to help somebody. That may be your whole job. So he's going to equip you to do it. So he's faithful to do that. Just like Isaiah, you know, Isaiah goes in the temple and he sees this glorious vision. He says, oh, woe is me, I'm doomed. Then God says, well, I got some stuff we got to do, so who should I send? Isaiah says, here I am, send me. He says, okay. He doesn't tell Isaiah, you know, I'd like to use you, but you haven't been to Bible college, you haven't been to seminary, you're not even a high school graduate. You don't have a computer. How many books have you read? He's going to prepare the person to do the work. And then he's talking about signs, you know, these last verses, these next verses are signs of the times. You know, the early signs of any growing season is the flowers come out. So now you know the winter's over. Now you know it's another season. The flowers come out. The vines are starting to bring forth grapes. Remember, we're not talking about Ohio. We're talking about the Middle East. Everything grows fast. So the vines are bringing forth grapes. Now the turtle doves are singing. I don't like your translation. The turtle doves are singing. In Israel, the turtle doves only sing during harvest time. They sing in the first harvest and the second harvest. This is why the Jewish Feast of Pentecost was the first harvest, and the Feast of Tabernacles was the second harvest. But the turtle doves sing at harvest time. So when he talks about the voice of the turtle doves is heard in the land, that means it's harvest time. We're living in harvest time. We're at the end harvest, the last harvest. So the turtle doves are singing everywhere. Whether Ariel Sharon died or not, Messiah's coming soon. So this is the last harvest, whether he comes back tomorrow or 50 years from now, we're living in the last harvest. So the turtle doves are singing. And people always sing while they're harvesting, because the harvest is a joyful time. You know, people are harvesting stuff, everybody's happy. Wow, look at all this fruit that came. Look at all these grapes. Look at all these. You know, we read about that in the Torah. You know, there's certain things you do during the harvest. So people are happy during the harvest. And there's smell of grapes. You know, if you've been, you know how it smells in September, October. You smell the apples and the grapes and the pumpkins. We have different growing seasons. So you have to put it in our terms. It would be like walking around in October going, wow, look at all the pumpkins, all the apples, all the stuff is ready. Flowers and fruits. And he talks to her always lovingly and with encouragement. He's never judgmental to her. You see that? He's always talking lovingly. Come on. You know, she's beautiful to him. But this is the time where now he's trying to take her out of her comfort zone. You know, we hear that term all the time. And into the work zone. You know, this is like, we know that the Holy Spirit gives us gifts. Right? So let's say he gets a gift of music. I mean, let's say he can play music, sing music, write music. Now, if he just sits in his living room here and plays music, sings, and there's nobody here but him, is that what it's for? Let's say you get the gift of hospitality, but there's nobody living in your house. You don't want anybody coming over. You just rearrange your house and say, boy, if anybody ever comes over, our house is all ready. That doesn't do anybody any good. If you get the gift of teaching, and you say, well, I'm just going to sit in my family room and I'm going to teach from Isaiah. There's nobody there. No, because the gifts are for the building up of the body. Right? Paul says in 1 Corinthians 12, it's for giving, building up of the body. So all these things are not just for us to enjoy, but we have to work with them. So he's drawing her out and says, this harvest is going on, and you can't just sit in the house. But she's not ready for that. She wants to sit in the house for another 3-4 chapters.